Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to you all. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Mudiwa Gavaza, and for today, we're getting into a discussion, you know, around, you know, the investment space, and we're going to be chatting with Daniel Dos Passos, who is, you know, a senior portfolio manager at RMB Indexation, you know, handling FNB ETFs. I hope I said that correctly, and we're just going to be having some discussions around, you know, some of you know, what he's looking after, and also, you know, some of the trends that they are seeing in the market, and hopefully that can at least inform or educate someone who's just sitting there and trying to consider their options. Daniel, thank you so much for being with us today.
Hi, Mudiwa. Thank you for having me.
Keen to understand. I think RMB is one of those names that is, you know, well known in the world of investments, Rand Merchant Bank, part of First Rand. But I will be honest, until I had to prepare for this discussion, I had not heard of RMB Indexation.
Yeah, thanks, Mudiwa. So I guess to put things in perspective, within the First Rand Group, our RMB Indexation team is our center of excellence for indexation type products. Indexation type products typically cover your passively managed funds, such as ETFs. And then within the First Rand Group, we then, you know, manage off balance sheet solutions for our clients through our various brands. So FNB ETFs being one of those brands, we also then manage products under our Ashburton brand as well, which is predominantly used for the off balance sheet solutions and traditional investments for investors. And I think that pretty much sums it up.
Okay, cool. Now, there's a lot that's, you know, there's a lot that's been said out there around this type of investing, right? And where I want to start today's discussion is probably a question that you've received many times, you know, because there is this tussle in the world of investment versus around passive versus active, you know, investments. And I would imagine that you'd carry an element of bias. So instead of asking passive versus active, what I would ask is, because when we judge investments, we usually judge them based on history, right? Has the track record of passive investing justified some of the, I'm going to call it hype, because there's a lot of people, at least some of the messaging would make it seem as if, get into the world of investments, entrust your money in people that actually know how to, you know, do it on your behalf, get into products, you know, that maybe are tracking a particular index or a particular market. And, you know, in the aggregate, as long as the general market is moving upwards over a long period of time, you're going to do well. Yeah. So just your thoughts, you know, around that, maybe as a stepping off point.
Sure thing. So I guess to put in perspective, there might be some bias in terms of we run passive products, which we like to call indexation, which is essentially just a rules-based strategy in terms of how to invest assets. Ironically enough, you'll find that I actually do believe in active management as well as passive management. I do feel they actually complement each other, which is quite an interesting thing, which is probably something you don't generally hear from passive managers. So to put it in perspective, obviously people are familiar with active management or traditional fund managers who look at the markets, try and understand the fundamentals of whatever the asset class it is that they're investing in and try and navigate the financial markets for you. Whereas on the passive side, we're following a rules-based solution to try and typically track an index and deliver returns with regards to their benchmark index. Now, one of the things, and you know, this isn't about the active versus passive debate. Obviously, passive is generally known for having low fees, but it also depends on the strategy that you're implementing. Sometimes it does also have higher fees if you're looking for something very bespoke. And I guess what I mean by that, and this is why I say active and passive can work very well together, is you get your more traditional market capitalization indices. And locally, we've got a top 40 index. Internationally, people will be familiar with the S&P 500. Or an MSCI World, S&P Global 1200 Index, et cetera. And those are just your general traditional benchmark indices. That's an allocation to an asset class or certain jurisdictions. But within that, you know, there's still an active decision which can also be made in terms of, do you want to be invested locally? Do you want to be invested offshore? Are you wanting to be invested in equities? Do you want fixed income investments? So although it is passive, and there can also, there's also active decisions to be made on the back end of that. And then also associated with those decisions from a passive point of view, we're just then looking to try and get you returns as close to that benchmark so that investors are a little bit, have a little bit more predictability and understanding of what the passive manager is trying to do. We tend to be a little bit more open book. That helps.
No, it certainly helps. And from a RMB indexation point of view, I think at the beginning, you know, I mentioned FNB ETFs, right? What's the structure, you know, of some of those, you know, because you mentioned a couple, you know, like the MSCI, you know, all of that stuff. People, you know, tend to have different approaches. What approach has your team taken when it comes to, I guess, the structure of FNB ETFs? And one of the things that I'm most curious for is, what is the purpose, right, for, you know, your indexation products? And I ask that because some people, when we talk about investment houses, they create some of these, you know, products, you know, for their clients, you know, maybe the retail investor that's part of the First Rand group. But in other cases, it might be, you know, as a tool for First Rand itself, you know, to be managing its own money.
Yes. So I think to put it in perspective, so let's just go right to the drawing board. So the ETFs or the exchange traded funds, all of our products are Cisco products, so collective investment scheme products, pretty much similar to a unit trust. Obviously, the differentiation being that the ETFs are listed on the JSE and trade similar to a share or security. And then within that, in terms of our current product set, we've gone with a more building block approach. So within our products, we try to give our investors access to specific asset classes that they can then look to invest in and make their informed decisions on. So what I mean by that is we have a couple local equity products, one being the top 40, your benchmark local equity index, I guess, in South Africa over the last couple of decades. We've got a mid-cap index, which then gives exposure to mid-cap shares within South African equities. And then we've also got a building block which links to inflation-linked bonds, which is quite an interesting asset class in itself. And then we also provide an offshore fixed income product and an offshore equity product. So within that scope, it's not like we're trying to force clients to make decisions or look at historical backtesting with regards to specific factors such as momentum, et cetera, but rather just provide the more generic building blocks from a traditional market cap point of view. And within that, you know, we do also have a couple of new or a few new ETFs, which we are looking at launching in the near future as well. Those will also be based on offshore equities. But again, we're just trying to cover the more traditional building blocks, which clients will be familiar with. And then that's allowing clients to build their own portfolios. And, you know, we also then solution that for our clients, you know, on an institutional basis as well. But from a retail perspective, I think, you know, it's just covering the general basis and allowing the investor to create their own portfolios.
I'll ask the typical client question. How's been the performance, you know, of the various ETFs, you know, depending on whatever time period you want to give us?
So it's interesting. Offshore exposures have typically performed better over the last few years, partially due to rand currency depreciation, because all our products are denominated in rand terms. But aside from that, our top 40 ETF has actually done pretty well. We've recently won awards for being the best ETF in South Africa for performance over a 5 and 10 year period. So, and over those periods, you know, returns have been pretty good. Equities obviously carries more risk. Within the risk, you know, you would hope for better returns. So they have performed well. And then I guess also then depending on the asset class that you're looking at, does depend on cycles. So certain asset classes will have cycles where they perform well, cycles where they underperform. I guess it's a matter of just trying to understand which cycle we're in and where you would like to be exposed over those various cycles.
Okay, cool. I think that that gives us a little bit of sense on that end. One of the more interesting discussions that's happened over time around I'm just going to call them ETFs. This is me literally just throwing something out and hoping that I can get an interesting response, you know, from you, Daniel. Is there was a lot of excitement when a couple of the large investors globally started making these types of products around crypto, right? So my question isn't around, you know, why do something like that, but rather the nature of equities is different from, you know, cryptos and that type of thing. My question is just more around, as a vehicle, is that an appropriate way of packaging exposure to an asset class like that? Because I guess that's what one of the things you're trying to do with an ETF. I know that it's very broad, but, you know, hoping you'll indulge me.
So it's quite an interesting one. And obviously, I'm going to try to stay away from the whole cryptocurrency as an asset class or debate as to whether, you know, people should be investing or disinvesting or not investing, should I rather say, in cryptocurrency. But I think what is interesting is you have touched on the point that there has been a few ETFs listed globally, which does reference crypto. And what's, in my opinion, I think that's actually probably a decent vehicle for investors to get exposure to cryptocurrency if they want to. And part of my reason for that comes down to, within an ETF structure, you land up bringing in, you know, a fair bit of regulations and compliance and reporting associated with creating those structures and having the backing of, you know, larger financial institutions, you know, providing oversight as opposed, you know, in the investment of those cryptos. So one of the things which I felt has been missing in the cryptocurrency space for a while, which a lot of people would advocate as to why you should consider it, is it is a decentralized version of finance in terms of investing in a means of exchange. But bringing it into the construct of an ETF does bring it a little bit closer to the views of the regulator with a little bit more oversight. And, you know, the general theory is better regulations and better oversight does protect the end investor. So I think it is an interesting step and probably a good step forward for the broader cryptocurrency going forward, especially if it is to gain further traction in the market.
Okay, cool. And on the local front, a country like South Africa, obviously risk appetite in the local market is much different than it is in other parts of the world. Do you see any move to create, you know, those types of products in the local, you know, context, or a South African investor wanting to get that type of exposure will probably be limited to some of those offshore types of options?
Yeah, so I guess to break it down into two aspects. So from a local equity point of view, our universe obviously is a lot smaller in terms of a universe of shares that clients can invest in relative to global markets. However, I do think locally our equities, you know, we do have quite an established equity market. Our equities are pricing relatively cheap compared to our global peers. So, you know, it's quite an interesting thing to look at, you know. The argument is it a value trap or is it maybe a good time to be getting into South African equities? You know, that's always a question for debate. But the reason why I would consider just breaking it down into two parts is that although our local equity market has been suffering a little bit in terms of the number of companies listed on it and the liquidity in those underlying companies, it is also being partially offset by an expanding range of ETFs. And those ETFs are giving you broader exposure to offshore assets. So it's actually making it easier and giving you more options in terms of what to invest in if you're wanting exposures outside of South Africa. And then even if you want exposures within South Africa, you know, there is quite a few well-established ETFs in the market which do give you exposure to local assets as well. So if you're not wanting to choose specific shares, but rather get a diversified exposure to local equities, there's quite a nice breadth of products out there. So as one part of the market seems to be losing a little bit of liquidity, I do think the whole ETF space and exchange-traded products as a broader sense are also trying to help fill that gap to give, you know, the various investors more options.
Yeah, definitely. And over time, I think it will be interesting to see how the risk appetite actually evolves, you know, from that point of view. Yeah, I think in the local context, it, yeah, there's certain mindsets that might need to be, you know, shifted to make some of that happen. But I want to maybe change gears a bit and come back to one of the things that you mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, Daniel, and that was around the fact that what people see as passive investing has an active element to it. And one of the things that I'm then, you know, keen to understand as a manager, you know, such as yourself, what's in the current environment, right? What's actually going into it? Because I'm pretty sure that there's a lot of noise in the world. There's a lot of noise in the markets. And you probably have to find a way to cut through all of that just to make sure that you are making the right decisions, tracking the right indices and that type of thing.
Yes, so it is interesting. And, you know, as I mentioned, using a passive product doesn't necessarily mean you're not being active in your decision in terms of what you're investing in. And I guess, you know, just to use some basic examples, if you are wanting exposure to South African equities, you know, you could use a top 40 ETF as the core to your portfolio or the main diversified piece of your portfolio. And then if you want to go overweight certain shares where you feel there's value, you can then still do that on the periphery and build out your portfolio with a general core, which is going to give you exposure to a local equity risk premium. And then, you know, being exposed to various sectors or companies if you want additional exposure. Likewise, the same thing would apply on a global scale, right? So common indices out there, if you want exposure to the American market, you can maybe invest in something like an S&P 500 ETF. But then if you're wanting more global exposure to developed markets, you've got MSCI World. There's also MSCI Emerging Markets, which then looks to focus on the emerging countries in the world and the companies associated with that. So even though those... So just using on the global scale, you've got American, you've got a world, you've got emerging markets. There's three different indices. It's offshore equity, but there's still an active decision to be made as to which form of those equities you want to be invested in. And, you know, in my opinion, I think it does give you a nice base or core to build your portfolios on. And then if there is the likes of a company such as NVIDIA, which has attracted a lot of attention recently, you could then look to gain exposure to NVIDIA through other means as well, just to, you know, play some of those themes. So I think it all fits together quite nicely. You can have active views while investing in passive products and then allocating across your portfolio in those various asset classes to meet your various requirements and risk appetite.
And for obviously, for someone that wants like real advice, they should probably give you a call. But from an approach point of view, right? Because I like the fact that you gave the example of an NVIDIA, right? Because when it comes to a decision on what does a person want exposure to and what they're going to invest in, a person could take a macro approach and say, okay, fine. If we use the top 40, for example, and take a macro approach and say, okay, fine, how has the top 40 performed over the last 10, 20, 30 years? What have been the returns, you know, all of that stuff, and keep it going. Whereas someone else might concern themselves with what is specifically making up, you know, this top 40. I guess where I am is humbly asking the question to say, you know, what's a good way, you know, of approaching something like that. I guess it feeds into the active piece that you were, you know, talking about just now, right? How active is active, right? Where do we draw the line between, you know what, at this point, you might as well just invest directly into an NVIDIA or something like that.
Yeah, so it's quite an interesting one. And, you know, obviously there's no elements of advice here. It's more just trying to share some of my personal insights. And I think if you talk about a specific share like NVIDIA, to be fair, you probably do need to do a lot of research, which I think is always important when doing an investment in terms of trying to understand the company. You know, is it a growth stock? Is it a value stock? What is its dividend payout ratio looking like? You know, has it run too much of late? Is there still more to happen? what is going to happen on the back end of AI linked to NVIDIA. And that starts becoming very stock-specific criteria, which you need to screen for. To be fair, a bit more of my skill set lies on the indexation side or understanding the indices. But I think even within that, it's quite an interesting side in terms of different indices still have the same elements that you need to concern yourself with. So has the index been running well? Does it have exposure to tech stocks? Is it tech heavy? Is it heavy in resources? Is it heavy in financials? Within those indices as well, you are going to get examples of your price to earnings ratios and dividend yields associated on the index on an overall weighted basis. So you can also then start formulating decisions around, well, I want exposure to equities as an example, but now, you know, what kind of PE ratio are you looking at? Do you feel that, for example, in South Africa, the current equity market is maybe pricing at a discount relative to international equities? And then you could make a decision, an active decision, to be fair, to invest in local equities, where you are going to be getting, you know, a hope of realization of a discounted valuation in the market and for it to return to some form of mean or fair value. And then on the back of that, you know, you're making an active decision, but you're doing a diversified portfolio as opposed to a single security. And then with that comes, you know, the opportunity for lower returns, but also you've got the diversification benefits of being invested in a portfolio. So it also helps mitigate your risk of the proverbial all your eggs in one basket scenario if you were to invest in a single share. And I think on the back end of that, that's also why I mentioned it's quite good for active managers and passive managers to actually work together, because using the passive building blocks and then allowing active managers to make active decisions, whether it's stock specific or macro pieces, also fits together quite nicely.
I want to stick on the theme of equities for a moment, because that's a world that I understand. If you have, let's say, a mid-cap ETF, right? Dynamics around, actually, let me use a small cap ETF to drive my point. If you have a small cap ETF, does the ETF tend to suffer from the same liquidity constraints that a typical small cap, you know, might suffer from? Because usually small cap companies don't have a lot of liquidity. There aren't that many people trading in that share and all of that. And just curious to understand, do some of those dynamics also feed onto the, you know, ETF side? If it's a small cap ETF, right, is it also going to have the same liquidity constraints, or are people more actively trading something like a small cap ETF? I don't know if the question I'm asking is clear.
Yeah, so I do understand where you're trying to get at. I think just to add some color caveats around that. So currently in South Africa, we don't have a small cap ETF. The reason for that is directly linked to the reasons that you've mentioned. So from an ETF issuer point of view, at least on our side, what we look at is if we're going to create a product or an ETF, we try to help ensure that there is sufficient liquidity in the actual index that we're trying to track or replicate. So within that, if we were to look at something like a small cap ETF, it wouldn't meet our requirements in terms of for us to be able to do justice in tracking that index, because we are going to potentially suffer illiquidity within those small cap stocks. So we could still trade the shares, we could still try to track the index, but we are going to have a higher tracking error. And once you start increasing your tracking error with reference to the index that you're actually trying to track, we feel we then land up doing the client a disservice, right? Because if the client is to be wanting exposure to the small cap index, but then our tracking error starts deviating significantly from that index itself, we feel as though we haven't, you know, necessarily delivered what the client would expect. So we would do a liquidity screening to try to determine which indices actually are viable and tradable from our liquidity constraints to be able to trade that that particular index. The irony is, and the caveat on that is that if you were to create an ETF on a small cap index, that ETF itself might actually collectively be more liquid than each of the underlying shares within the small cap space, because it is a consolidated basket. And, you know, sometimes what you can see happen is that if you're creating a product on something that is illiquid on the back end, it indirectly helps improve the liquidity within the small cap space. So, you know, there's quite interesting dynamics which will come into play there. But I think that's also why you find that going to that, a lot of the managers, they won't create products linked to equities, which has got illiquidity concerns on the back end of it, as a way to indirectly protect their clients. You know, I think we do still have a fiduciary duty from a professional portfolio manager point of view to when we create products, we do need to believe that they're products which we feel our investors will be interested in. And we create them, you know, with our common sense in the back end of, do we think it's viable in the long term for our investors to invest in?
That's actually, you know, that helps us to understand that quite a bit. Yeah, because I was wondering about that, to say how much do the dynamics around individual components of ETF, how much does that influence liquidity, you know, in that? And that point that there could possibly be more liquidity for an ETF as opposed to the components, that's an interesting one. How do some of those dynamics fare for your mid-cap fund?
So a mid-cap fund, the security itself, or the ETF itself, so we do have a market maker. So the market maker does provide liquidity and confirm liquidity for our investors on screen. So the ETF itself, if you were to compare it to the liquidity which you might be able to obtain in some of the underlying shares within it, the liquidity is good. You know, through the market maker, there can be larger volumes which can be facilitated. You know, there is, within the mid-cap space, there is still some companies which are quite large within the mid-cap space. And then some of the smaller companies just end up having a smaller weight in the index. So a lot of the hedging or mitigating risks falls on the market maker themselves to navigate that. And what you would find, that just because it is a traditional market cap index in a sense, the larger cap shares do have larger weightings and are more liquid. So majority of that risk is actually directly offsettable within the market. So liquidity on our mid-cap ETF is good. The reason why we went with the mid-cap ETF is that we actually did liquidity screening on that when we launched it back in 2012, and it has been able to hold over the years, is that there is still sufficient liquidity from a trading point of view on screen to justify a mid-cap index. We have actually looked at a small-cap index before in the past as well, and linked to my previous comments, we decided that it's not really viable from a product point of view. So there is liquidity screening. And just to clarify, a lot of the index providers themselves, when creating indices, embedded within that index and part of their rules, and this is why I mentioned it, is a rules-based approach, they do have liquidity screening on the underlying shares to justify inclusion into a particular index as well. So just to clarify, again, as an example, on our all-share index in South Africa, it covers 99% of the listed market cap within South Africa in terms of equities, but there is a liquidity screening requirement on that as well as part of the inclusion in the index. So if shares didn't meet that requirement, they wouldn't form a part of the index.
All right, that makes sense. And I'm glad that you touched on, you know, that composition, because I was going to ask on the mid-cap side, you know, especially for someone who isn't familiar with it, is it broadly all mid-caps, you know, that are listed on the exchange? Or, you know, you've obviously spoken about this screening that you guys have on the liquidity side, but, you know, is there a cap, you know, under which you say, actually, this might be too small for us, for it to be mid?
Yeah, so the mid-cap index itself over the years has evolved. So I'll just talk to its current state. So the current state of the mid-cap index looks to cover, roughly speaking, the market cap in listed equities between just over 85% to then 95% of listed market cap. And then the first 85% is covered in what the JSE calls the large cap index. So that covers 85% of the listed equity market cap. Then the mid cap covers that space from 85 to 95, roughly. And then the small cap index covers from 95 to 99. So in theory, if there is something which fails to meet the requirements as part of the index calculations, even if it is a mid cap stock, and there could be other reasons as to why those shares could be excluded from the index. Obviously, not to dwell on specific events in the past, but if there was a share which was to be suspended for whatever reason, you know, it would then get removed from the index as well. So there is a number of rules associated with the calculation of an index, which can also, you know, result in shares being excluded from the index, even if they are a sizable enough company.
Okay. Before we let you go, Daniel, the other thing was is costs, right? Because all of this takes money to do, to provide, and to service, you know, over time. Maybe you could talk to us just around maybe some of those dynamics when it comes to costs, how you guys are thinking about it, and, you know, perhaps how an investor could be thinking about, you know, approaching some type of a passive product.
Yeah, sure. So obviously, when it comes down to costs, and this, you know, going right back to the beginning of the interview, and we touched on comments around active versus passive, the one thing which has often been sold on a passive side is typically lower costs compared to active portfolio managers. So the lower costs, you know, directly feeds through into your performance over the longer term. So if you had to take a fund which was charging you 1% fees versus a fund charging you 0.1% fees, each year there is a cost saving of 90% or 0.9% or 90 basis points, as we refer to it. So that is something which is important, and that cost saving does play out in the longer term. From our perspective, we look to try to be very competitive with our fees. A lot of our products are amongst the lowest, or targeted to be the lowest within the market, because we do believe those fees are very important for clients. And then on the back end of that, it does also allow scope for various fund managers and advisors, etc., to use our products as part of building a solution for clients to actually, you know, generate returns with their active views, whilst knowing that they are using relatively low cost products as well, so that they're not overpaying for the basics, and then they can actually use and apply their skill and oversight to extract additional revenues and advice for the investors.
All right. Before we let you go, just the one more thing on our side. How do you see, we sort of alluded to this earlier on when we were talking about crypto, but it's more a question around how do you see passive investing evolving, you know, in South Africa. I was talking to some index providers recently, and they were talking to say that these types of products have sort of become a mainstay, you know, in a country like South Africa. And, you know, many, both retail and institutional investors have them as part of their, what you call this, as part of their portfolio. Do you see that trend continuing, where we just swing almost, if it's a spectrum between active and passive, where we just continue to move towards more passive invest, what people consider passive investing, or do you see pockets, you know, where you might have the, I don't know what word to use. I'm just thinking about that moment during COVID around GameStop and Robinhood and all of that stuff, where there's a block of people that, you know, actually say, I want to, you know, do this by myself and actively, you know, do it. How do you see that pendulum continuing to swing?
So there's quite a lot of interesting insights there, you know, with reference to our local market and then also international markets. And I think the local ETF space in South Africa is growing. A lot of the products are still along the more traditional main theme of traditional market cap. What is happening on a global scale is within ETFs and indexation products is you are starting to see a lot of factor type products. So what I mean by a factor type product is, instead of just looking at, you know, traditional market cap, they might have a growth factor or a value factor, which they look to play on as a part of that index. Is also getting a lot of thematics. So thematics being trying to play across a general theme. So you could have an energy theme. You could have a theme around AI, you know, fourth industrial revolution as an example. So these factors. And there's themes, which again talks to how I mentioned that although they are passive or indexation-based building blocks, obviously there's a very active view which you need to place within that. And I think to go to context with what you're referring to during COVID and what happened with the likes of GameStop, is in South Africa, a lot of our investors and a lot of the market itself is, there's a lot of institutional investors at play, and our overall retail investor market is a lot smaller in terms of their influence on the equity market within South Africa. In America, the retail market has a significantly higher market share and is able to apply significantly higher influence to the movement of shares within that particular market. So the likes of the run on GameStop and that performance over that period of time, or those meme stocks, was largely just due to a high market share for the retail investor who are able to manipulate those prices, or maybe manipulate is not the right word, but to move those prices in a certain direction. And in South Africa, we don't necessarily quite have that element playing through into our market as of yet. And then on the US side of things, also on the back end, is that a lot of the investors, instead of trying to buy single shares, they also actually are using ETFs actively across their spectrum. So the SPDR ETF, or the ETF which tracks the S&P 500, is amongst one of, if not the most liquid instruments in equity markets in the world. So it also just goes to show how markets have evolved. I think over time, with where we are locally in our ETFs, we are actually going to see some further evolution. We have lagged global markets in terms of the adoption of ETFs, but I do think it's coming. And I think given the universe that we have in our local equity markets, it's actually going to play out quite favorably. And then it does give us exposure to offshore asset classes as well.
All right. So that's where we end off for today. It has been a great discussion with Daniel, just giving us the lay of the land when it comes to passive investment products in the South African investment landscape, specifically ETFs. Those are exchange traded funds, talking just around what their use is in the current environment, the return profile, and also at the same time giving us a sense of how people are, making use of some of these products. We started off talking about the fact that even though these things are perceived to be passive, there is, quite an active element, that comes around, how people actually allocate the money and, where, and making some of those investment decisions. Also talking quite a bit, around some of the global trends, that we have seen, some of the decisions that investors are taking in terms of getting that local exposure versus getting that international exposure. But I would say for myself, one of the more fascinating elements was understanding some of the liquidity dynamics, at play. If you have a bunch of mid-sized companies, does the level of liquidity in those specific counters filter into a combined product such as an ETF? And it was great hearing Daniel just articulating some of those dynamics using the example of a small cap fund, and he explained to us why there are no small cap ETFs in South Africa, because of some of those liquidity constraints that might come through, but at the same time letting us know that it is possible that you may see more liquidity in something like that. And then on it off, of course, talking about where the pendulum, sort of swings in a country like South Africa. And at the moment, it does seem as if the world of passive investing and ETFs, is going to continue to be strong. And, Daniel anticipating that there's going to be even more growth, going forward. So that's been it. Talking to Daniel Dos Passos, who is a senior portfolio manager over at RMB Indexation. Daniel, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Madiba.
And that's been it for this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcasts on Business Live. That's under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab on Twitter with hashtag BD Spotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your pods casted. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail, and this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So for myself and the rest of the team, it is a good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.